Welcome to Steel Watching, which is a podcast for Remington Steel fans. My name is Sarah, and I am hopefully crossing my fingers we don't have any tech issues.
I'm Eric, and I'm the one who probably causes most of those tech issues. So, anyway.
And we're going to be talking today about the season two episode, A Steel at Any Price. So this one aired first on November 1st, 1983. And it was written by Richard DeRoy and directed by Mitch Paradise. So there are a couple names we haven't heard before. And also, how cool would it be to have the last name Paradise?
Yeah, well, you could, especially if you had two tickets.
Yeah, I hoped you'd make that joke, because if you hadn't, I was going to do it. So there we are.
And for anybody who is younger than us, that's an Eddie Money song, Two Tickets to Paradise. So
I bet that was a lot. Like, he could have used that as a pickup line a lot. Hey, baby, I've got one.
Such a bad image.
I'm sorry, Mitch Paradise. Wherever you are, we apologize.
Yes.
Anyway. I decided to go with the TV guide listing, even though I'm not super duper keen on some of the wording.
Okay.
So I'll read it and I'll explain why. It said, Remington tries to penetrate a ring of international art thieves who may be responsible for a reporter's disappearance. Laura's nowhere in that description. So that's kind of why I was like, it should read, in my opinion, Laura and Remington try to penetrate a ring of international art thieves. That is how I would have written it. But I wasn't as keen on either of the other two descriptions either. So
really?
That's what I went with. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Did you have a preference?
Well, yeah, I figured you'd go with the DVD liner notes.
Interesting. Okay. You want to read them, or do you have them up?
Yeah. Laura fears Remington is enjoying himself a bit too much when a case calls for them to pull off a series of highly dangerous art thefts to thwart some crooks.
See, the issue that I had with that, it said, you just read Laura fears that Remington might be enjoying himself a bit too much, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Right. Isn't it Laura that starts enjoying herself a bit too much?
Well, yeah.
That was the issue I had with that one, too. Like, that should have been swapped, right? So that's why I didn't use that one, because it's kind of the other way around in this episode. So,
yes.
So, yeah, and also, there was an interesting note from Judith's book that I thought I would read out as well. During the filming of this episode, Pierce became a first-time father as Cassie gave birth to their son, Sean William Walter Brosman. He was given the middle name, William, as a tribute to Doris Roberts' late husband and Pierce's stepfather. So I thought that was kind of cool.
Judith Moose. Still loved after all these years.
We make him say Judith's name on every podcast just to see how it'll turn out. Sorry, Judith.
Yeah, you know.
It's a lot of fun.
Words are tough. Anyway.
So any overall thoughts on this episode before we get into the...
I wouldn't even put a Pitkins in my bathroom.
Oh, we'll get to our thoughts on Pitkins.
Yes, we will. Anyway.
I enjoy this episode. It's one of those episodes, though, where I forget the bulk of the plot until I rewatch it, which is not maybe
a good thing to say.
The most enthusiastic endorsement, but it's not like I dislike it. It's just one of those episodes where you start watching and you're like, oh, yeah, this happens. So that's kind of where I'm at with that one. But either way, it has some really good moments. And it has the guy from the actor whose name Jeffrey Jones. That's it. Who plays Clifford Conant, the villain, and also, of course, plays the principal in Ferris Bueller's Day Off, as well as the villain in Howard the Duck, and he's in a bunch of other movies playing a bad guy. So this is kind of a good role for him. It kind
consistent
of fits
with his character.
Yeah, it really is. So our opening scene, we open at the Conant Art Gallery, where an artist named, artist is using the term very loosely here, named Joanne Pitkin has been declared Artist of the Month with her painting on display. It is a pink canvas with basically just paint splattered all over it haphazardly.
Can I read the line from the script?
Oh, yes. Yes. Go for it.
This is the scene where they're changing from the contemporary painting, the one that is originally auctioned off, to putting hers up. And it says that it calls it an abstract that might be the coagulated droppings of an inept house painter.
I can't think of a more perfect description. So
exactly.
Forget what I just said about what it looks like. That's what it looks like. Literally, that's it right there.
Yep, that's it.
And then we go to a stage where an auction is taking place and people are bidding over $400,000 for something that looks like a bunch of gold boxes with no discernible shape. So yeah, apparently this is art, folks. I don't get it any more than you do, but here we are. Nope. And so then we have Conant, the owner of the art gallery, and he's... Now, this is the first thing that kind of confused me. Do you usually have gallery owners as auctioneers? Don't they usually have, like, a person that's specifically hired as an auctioneer, or... Aren't they the guys that yell, like, you can't hear what they're saying, but apparently everybody else can?
Right. I'm not an expert on auctions. However, I would say, yes, you're probably correct. The only time that might be different is if the gallery owner happens to be a qualified auctioneer. I don't know that Conant is or isn't.
Or, you know, an international art thief.
Yes. Well.
Could be.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. But, so anyway.
But, you know, in this scenario, it would make sense that he would become qualified as an auctioneer because he'd want to keep as few people involved in the knowledge of what's going on as possible.
That is true.
And he wants to control the outcome of the auction. So,
yeah. So, yeah, he's he's doing the auction and he introduces the local artist of the month, Joanne Pitkin. And I described her art as being like this quote painting is almost the same as the other piece, except it's different shape, tall and coming to a point at the top, which is important, with a white background, but still basically with color splattered all over it, like a paint swatch threw up. So he introduces her work saying it is still maturing. You know what else is still maturing? Some of the mold that grew on my fruit when I was away at vacation. And declares that this little piece titled Anxiety One is one of her most complex visions.
The way he delivers that line, he says, Anxiety One is one of the artist's most, and then there's a pause, and it's not scripted.
He can't describe.
But yeah, I mean, actor really understood what the character's attitude about this art is.
Yeah,
he definitely. Yeah, he knows it's garbage. And even he's having trouble knowing what he does know about why he's doing this. Even he has trouble saying the words.
And I mean, I don't know about you, but that is not what my anxiety looks like. Though maybe all that means is that you get anxious just looking at it.
Who knows? I mean, why does anybody name anything, you know, in the art world?
The meaning of life.
Yeah, Lex. Especially abstract works. You know, the
banana.
Masters, the Renaissance masters, they named their paintings for things that made sense. You know, it's a painting of a young girl in blue or whatever. But yeah, some of this contemporary stuff. Okay, what were you smoking when you were doing this?
Yeah, I'm not inclined to argue with any of that. So yeah, it's accurate. And he starts the bidding at $1,000 as the camera pans to a woman in a dark suit, who we later know is Monica Haddon. Then there is also Koji Asuda, who is also looking at the painting, along with a few other people, including Mr. Schneiderman, who is also one of the three treacherous trio, as they are dubbed later on in the episode. So she bids $1,000 just as Mr. Schneider. Oh God, I'm not going to be able to say this. Schneiderman bids $1,100. And here's a blast from the past. Do you remember when it was legal to smoke inside any building?
Oh yeah.
He's just sitting there puffing on a cigar. And I mean, I remember this too, but it's just weird when you watch it in movies and you're like, dude, you're smoking inside. Take that outside. What are you doing?
Well, even in airplanes, I mean, yeah, it used to be legal to smoke in hospitals. Airplanes.
You could smoke in hospitals. You could have your doctor just light up a cigarette while he's diagnosing your cancer, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's just kind of funny. Hey,
you know, you got to experience in order to diagnose it.
Fair. Yes, I know. the same, Monica Haddon then bids $1,200. He bids $1,300. She looks a little dismayed. Sorry. I'm wrong. This is Molly. Molly's bidding. Mm-hmm. Yeah. My notes are kind of funny. Yeah. So Molly is bidding and they're kind of looking a little nervous. The treacherous trio, they're sitting there. She shoots a look at the man sitting opposite her, which is Mr. Schneiderman, before putting up her hand and bidding $1,400. He bids $1,500. Molly ups the ante by bidding $1,600. As this takes place, you can see that Conant is looking less and less impressed. Mm-hmm. Koji Isuda looks back at Monica and over at Mr. Schneiderman. He looks as if he's going to bid again, but Conant subtly shakes his head at him and calls $1,600 twice before declaring it and selling it to Molly, who holds up the number 9.
Number 9.
So here's my question.
Number 9.
So deep cut there.
A Beatles fan will recognize that.
Yeah. Yes. If the auction was fixed, why not just let one of the treacherous trio outbid her?
Because they need to keep the price somewhat in line with reality.
But starting it at $1,000 already exited the realm of reality, in my opinion.
Well, yeah, but I mean, we're talking art here, so yeah.
Are we?
You never know. And what had Pitkins previously sold for? You know, there's a whole bunch of different factors that I imagine would come into play, and. Yeah, they probably want to just keep it in a certain range to make it consistent with what had been sold before by her works.
Fair enough. I also wonder if it's maybe because Conant was suspicious of why this woman was bidding on this painting, because everybody in that room knows it's crap. Like,
well,
nobody in there.
Of course he's suspicious. Art, you know? And we find out later that he even says, gives us the reason why he's suspicious.
Yeah, exactly.
Suspicious, yeah.
She's an art critic. Mm-hmm. So she stands up to go and collect her painting, and they all kind of watch her anxiously. Mm-hmm. And then we get like a time fade, and the room is now empty. The only person left is, I think it was... Rick
Walker.
Rick. Sorry, Rick's
Rick
sitting
Walker.
There. My
Richard.
Richard. my early notes, I didn't remember his name. So I'm like, the man, the woman. And now I'm trying to remember who he is. Yes, sorry, Richie. He's
Vacations
sitting there.
Vacations will do that to you folks.
This is what happens when you go away.
You come back and you have to take a vacation from your vacation.
I really do. So he's sitting there waiting and she hasn't returned. He's upset. Mm-hmm. He's worried. And that's kind of the end of the opening sequence there. Mm-hmm. We get a scene change to the outside shot of the Century City Towers, and he's in the office. Steele relays back what he was told by the gallery that his partner, Molly Donovan, he's in the office with Steele. He relays what he was told by the gallery and his partner, Molly Donovan, paid for her painting and left. Laura tells Mr. Walker at this point, that's what he's going by, that the Conant Gallery practices its share of felonies. I like this. Their prices are highway robbery. Their arrogance is criminal. And they should do hard time for some of the artists they represent. Wow. Interesting to see Laura having such passionate opinions on an art gallery. Is this on brand or is Steele rubbing off on her?
Well, as a detective, she would probably at some point have been involved in some cases involving art. Oh, I wonder.
Yeah.
I wonder, you know, maybe there was a case where they had to steal a painting or something like that. I don't know. Anyway, but no, at some
Do
point,
we know
she
if that
been
was the same gallery, though. Like, how many galleries does LA have?
No. But, you know, she's probably had some more contact with the art world in the course of her business. And. She probably has some familiarity with the Conant Gallery and some other galleries. And so she's got an idea that Conan Gallery isn't exactly the most reputable of organizations. But yeah, Steele could be rubbing off on her. I mean, that happens.
True, it does. And we see this more of that in this episode. But she does say that kidnapping doesn't seem to be in their line. And then Rick, as we're calling him right now, because that's what he's trying to be, says, maybe, maybe not, but does not elaborate. Steele tries to coax him, and all he does is repeat himself. Laura walks around him, and then he bumps into her, accidentally spilling coffee on her blouse, and immediately tells her that vinegar will take that out as long as she gets to it before it dries. That doesn't sound like the image he's trying to project. So there's our first clue that Rick Walker is not who he seems to be. Steele points out that's the longest sentence he's said since walking through the door. And then, of course, his response, other people talk. Rick Walker listens. Laura tries to get him to explain what he means by that. And he says that he and Molly are investigative reporters for the LA Tribune, which is stretching the truth more than a little bit. And Laura asks if he's investigating the gallery. He hints that he is, but he says it's hush hush, to which Steele kind of, you can see Steele's bemusement on his face. He's kind of,
you want us to help you, but you won't tell us anything about what's going on. Yeah.
You can tell us, you know, he says sort of confidentially to him. And then we can Rick keep suggests, a secret. Yeah, that Steele go to the gallery and rough them up a bit. Yeah. That's when Laura loses her patience, saying that you may have noticed the sign on the door is Remington Steele, not Sam Spade, which is kind of funny considering, was it High Flying Steele where he, or Steele Flying High, I can never remember which one that was, where he attempted to be Sam Spade throughout a good chunk of the episode. So yeah, Rick gets frustrated and says that if anything happens to Molly, he'll never forgive himself. Steele says that's not his longest answer he gave, but it is the most persuasive. So that convinces them at least that something is going on, or at least that he's worried something is going on. So they arrive at the gallery to see the featured artist painting outside. Steele is appalled, saying, Molly Donovan paid money for this? And Laura says, for an expose. And he replies, exposing what? A shocking lack of talent?
I like that line.
That's really good. It is a really good line. And even I think Laura's amused by it. She comments, and here's this is a little confusing. She says that she didn't realize he had such definite opinions on art.
Yeah, really. Why would she be surprised about this? I mean, that's right there in my notes.
Yeah, right?
Like, same point.
I mean, and his response is pretty perfect. He says, well, you know, he's spent a lot of time trying to steal some of the finest works of art, so it makes sense that he would have opinions on it.
Yeah, and then her line after he says that, I do my best to forget that. Well, even if she truly did try her best to forget it, she wouldn't have.
No,
you know,
no,
she might push it out of her daily thoughts, but forget it? No. So it's, yeah, I mean, there's some good lines, but yeah, they're a little inconsistent.
So some of this episode feels inconsistent, and we'll get to some more of that later on. But you're right. There are parts of it that feel like it's a little bit. And I wonder if this is, again, that early season two, trying to remind the viewers of who these people are.
Could be.
Because it's episodic television, not serialized. But it is refreshing to see him not shy away from his criminal past verbally, even if Laura does say that she tries to forget it. Because in season one, he wouldn't have even mentioned it at all. Or he might have been very cagey about it because he knew that Laura disapproved of his former profession. So at least here, he still demonstrates, she still shows that she disapproves, but it's more kind of affectionate than it is mistrustful. And he seems almost proud of some of his former exploits. So
yes,
I think this is kind of a...
And he has managed to pull her into his world on occasion. Now, granted, she could say, well, it's for a good cause, you know, the one with Felicia and the other one with the paintings. But she can be bent.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. And it doesn't even really take much to get to that point. So. But Laura looks over and notices Joanne Pitkin loading her paintings into a very nice car. She remarks on it, saying it's a nice car for a struggling artist. And he says, makes you wonder who she's been struggling with, which is kind of funny. She decides to look into it and asks him if he can handle this bastion of culture alone. And well, he kind of, what?
I want to reference those couple of lines from Laura and Remington, because he says, makes you wonder who she's been struggling with. And Laura's line is, you think you can penetrate that bastion of culture alone. Intentional or inadvertent double entendre? I don't know.
Oh, no, I'm going to assume it's intentional. I always assume a double entendre is intentional in this show because they got away with a lot.
Well, that's true.
So, yeah. And then he says, well, she's changed his life, and he's actually looking forward to going through the front door. Which is cute. I like that. But this is also a really good example of a bit of how they've changed, because in the past she would not have trusted him to do this part on his own. Mm-hmm. She would have gone with him for sure. Like if Murphy and Bernice were still around, this would have been something that either she would be doing or she would have Murphy do.
Right.
I think.
Right.
But he goes in. He bumps into Mr. Schneiderman. That guy, he rushes out barely looking back. And then we switch to him, Steele, and talking to Conant. He says it's obviously a lover's tiff and that Molly Donovan got carried away. And Steele agrees, and then he clarifies with her purchase. He goes on to now, say that, well,
Can I comment about Conant's remark here? I think what we're dealing here with is a lover's misunderstanding. Oh, really? Why would he go there? I mean, as the audience, of course, we have enough information that this would make sense as a possibility to us because of Rick's comment earlier in the office.
Yeah.
But how would Conant have had that information? How would he have gotten to that point just from Molly Donovan sitting in the, whatever they call it, the audience or the,
the gallery,
congregation, whatever it is, you know, and bidding on a painting and then paying for it and leaving, if that's exactly what happened, which is what he had told Richie. How would he get from point A to point Z like that? I mean, this is got to be a clue that he knows more than he should.
It's a big one. I don't think he's used to having somebody poke his nose into whatever legal stuff he's doing. So he's not very good at it.
Yeah. Okay.
And then he goes on to say that while she's only a third string art critic, she has an eye for talent. That must have hurt for him to actually have to say those words out loud. That must have been hard. And then he goes on to say it must have cost her a month's salary to buy Anxiety One. And Steele says he hopes that that's the only anxiety she's bought.
Yeah. And Steele also, earlier in that exchange, Conant had said that Miss Donovan may have gotten carried away with her purchase and Steele says, I suspect the same thing. And he, with her purchase. So there's a good back and forth between these two of Conant saying one thing and Steele turning it around and sticking him with it.
Although I kind of wonder as to the point of the scene overall, because he shuts down the conversation saying it's becoming pointless, and then it's over. Like the scene is done. And I don't know. I wonder if it was just to fill in time or to show us, because we know that Conan's involved. It's not like that's a mystery. So.
Right.
I don't know.
There might've been a purpose, but maybe there was something else that had changed in the course of the script. And
true.
It changed the context and the significance of this interaction. So who knows?
Then we've got, outside, we've got the people inside the treacherous trio. They're talking to Conant's assistant, demanding to know who Remington Steele is. He says, it's nothing he's interested in, to which he responds, you know who I'm interested in. And then he goes on to say that the delay is bad for his blood pressure. Then we've got Monica Haddon's voice. She adds to him to give him a message from her as well. She tells the assistant to remind Conant of the Venice Art Festival that ended so tragically. She explains that she had contracted to purchase a unique Rubens, but the man entrusted to deliver it thought he could find a better price. She hints that as a result, he was killed, saying, all those canals, and that they never found the body. She seems well, you to know, take.
What's interesting about this? What's interesting about this is Ron, which is the name of the receptionist there, the assistant.
Right.
Yeah. He doesn't seem to be all that concerned about anything until she shows up.
She scares the bejesus out of him.
Oh, yeah.
And seems to take like this psychotic delight in rehashing this one particular episode.
Yes.
Because he swallows nervously and he promises to pass it on. And we find out later that that particular incident, the man that he was going to deliver the painting to where he thought he could find a better price was Mr. Steele. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of a fun little bit of info that we get later on.
Yeah. But she relishes that story. To her, it's like.
She really does.
Delicious food.
Oh, she really does. Yeah. She's truly psychotic. Very much. Yes. And I enjoy like her. The actress's performance is really good for this. It just, she chews the scenery anytime she's on camera and it's great.
Yep.
So then we get another scene change. Laura has followed Joanne Pitkin all the way to her house and it's huge. It is pretty much an estate. She gets out and Joanne Pitkin asks her how she found her there. Laura says it's part of her job, introduces herself as an art critic from Art Insight magazine. I think she does a pretty good job of being an art critic from Art Insight, but what I don't understand is why she used her real name here and not one of the many others they've used.
Myrtle Groggins, perhaps?
Myrtle Groggins. Like any one of those like other names would have worked really well in this particular instance, but she uses her real name, which is kind of interesting.
Yeah. Which it's probably not a good move on her part.
No. And I mean, but I don't think Joanne Pitkins is too worried about it, or Pitkin, sorry, when she hears the words Art Insight. She immediately perks up. She says, even Cliff Conant doesn't understand your articles. To which Laura replies, we do believe that obscureness is the avenue towards revelation with a sharp left turn at referential analysis.
Anybody for a word salad? Would you like dressing on that?
Yeah, that's definite word salad. And it also
What does it even mean?
Well, it reminds me of the saying, just because nobody understands you does not make you an artist, right? So this is obviously her attempt to be so word salad-y that she sounds smart but isn't.
Yeah.
But it impresses Joanne Pitkin. She has no idea what Laura is talking about either, but she is excited that they're interested in her. So. Yeah. It works. Mm-hmm. Laura comments on a potential profile, maybe even a cover, and remarks that Joanne does seem to be prospering. She hints at her mansion being a prison, and Laura comments that her bio says she lives in a garret in Hermosa Beach. What's a garret? Do you know what a garret is?
No.
Okay.
Not off the top of my head.
I thought one of us might. I, again, should have Googled this, because I was like, that sounds like...
Real quick here on, what is it, probably dictionary.com or Oxford Languages. It's a top floor or attic room, especially a small, dismal one, traditionally inhabited by an artist.
Oh, okay. So she really is playing the part of the struggling artist.
Yes. Well, you know, I will take her prison. I wouldn't complain about it.
Yeah, I will sign up for that, too. Yeah. She says that it sounds better and that Hermosa Beach is in here and, you know, points to her heart. So she asks about the cover again and Laura shrugs and says, after all, we gave one to Picasso.
I mean,
okay.
How could anyone be so arrogant or dense as to.
Yeah. Yeah.
To fall for that. Okay. Yeah. You look like your paintings. Yeah. Yeah. They're a drop cloth. Yeah.
They look like someone threw up. Yeah. I was.
But you're a Picasso. Yeah.
Mm, yeah. No. Sure. If Picasso was really drunk, like really drunk.
No, so, I think even drunk Picasso would do better than that.
Fair. Joanne Pitkin is convinced, though. She invites her to come in and stay for dinner. Hey, stay for the month.
Yeah.
Yeah. So then we get a scene change. We see Molly tied to a chair. She's obviously been not treated very nicely. Conant is there, and his assistant brings him a microphone hooked up to some sort of machine. He asks her who she's working for. When she says no one, he asks her why she bids so relentlessly on Anxiety One. I gotta say, I love the fact that it is just assumed by literally everyone in the room that the art is so bad that not only would a person, would nobody willingly bid on it, but like you have to torture this person to find out why.
Yeah, I mean, it's obvious. Everybody does know that it's bad. Yeah. except
Joanne Pitkin. She thinks she's made the big time.
She's a great artist. Yeah.
Yeah. So poor Molly claims to like Pitkins, to which Conant scoffs and says, a woman with her critical eye and judgment wouldn't hang a Pitkin in her broom closet. It's obvious he knows she's not a third string art critic. So yeah, they're all aware of where what's going on here.
Well, I would say even a third string art critic would know better than to bid on a Pitkin.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not an art critic and I can look at that and say that's terrible. It's not really art. She makes a lame comment about the Impressionists having faced similar criticism. He is not impressed. He puts the headphones on her and plays the 1812 Overture at full volume, stopping again to ask why she bid on it. She then says,
I've got to say, Conant, I don't understand Conant's comment and his selection of the portion of the 1812 that he did. He says, perhaps some Tchaikovsky would help, the 1812 Overture. The brass is so effective. Well, the canon would be far more effective. And in fact,
I thought the same thing.
In fact, in 1979, Telarc, which is a record, a high-end classical music record company originally, and then expanded into some other things later on, they released a digital recording of the 1812, which had actual canons used in it. The end of the recording, and they placed warnings throughout the packaging to keep the volume low initially until the listener can determine a safe level for playback because the canons go off so loudly. In fact, one reviewer called it gut-shaking thuds that it could rupture speaker cones. Now, think of what that would do to the human ear and the human head and brain through headphones. Why did he choose that? I don't get it. The guy's a lousy criminal, and he's a lousy torturer.
He's just as bad at torture as he is at his criminal enterprises. I have to agree because there are a lot more musical pieces that would be effective in this scenario. I mean, granted, they hadn't
anything from the '90s. Oh.
Just Justin Bieber, Nickelback. I can make a list.
A lot of things from the '80s.
Yeah, that's
Technopop.
True. Yeah. I agree. He turns the music back up. It is having an effect though. So poor Molly is being tortured with Tchaikovsky. And then we go back to Joanne Pitkin's estate. She's telling Laura that Cliff Conant changed her life. She bought all sorts of expensive art from him before, including a Cezanne in the powder room. Laura comments, how nice for your guests. And she says, well, you got to look at something. And I have to say, I don't disagree with that. In fact, when we were away on vacation, my daughter had to pee. And so we went into one of the public bathrooms that they had in Lunenburg, Nova Scotia. And there was a sticker on the outside of the stall. And I swear to God, the sticker said, have a nice poop. And I know they tell you that they're friendly out east, but that really kind of pushes it a little far. However, I took a picture. I couldn't help myself. I was like, well, I mean, if you're going to tell me to have a nice poop, I'm going to at least take a picture of it. So not the sticker, not the...
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah. I just thought that... I guess you do have to look at something, is all I'm saying.
Yes. So. Yeah, that's why reading is so popular in the bathroom, I guess.
That's true. There's always like, you know, in people's spare bathrooms and stuff, there's usually a little book, you know.
You know, and there's actually books that you can get that are they're called bathroom readers.
The bathroom
they're
readers.
Just short little things.
Just give you a little info. Yeah. She then reveals that her ex-husband owned 863 pizza franchises, which is clearly where her money comes from. Mm-hmm. Which you'd think that, I guess they must not have named them like Pitkin's Pizza or whatever, because you'd think that Laura would have put two and two together if there were that many franchises that were owned by.
Well, except it was Pitkin's Pizza Palazzo's.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
863 franchises across the country.
She's not a fan of. What's a palazzo?
Like, I don't know, like a plaza or something.
Oh, I thought it was like a type of food. You know how they have those, like, what are they called? They're like folded over and the pizza's inside them.
Oh, yeah. Calzones?
Yeah, yeah. So I thought maybe it was like a calzone or...
Let's see. According to the Cambridge Dictionary, a palazzo is a large, beautiful Italian house, especially one that a member of a royal family or a person of high social rank used to live in.
So he really thought a lot of his pizza then.
Yes.
Which makes sense considering how highly she thinks of her paintings.
Yes.
So, okay. Well, there we have our answer. She tells Laura that when she and her husband split up, she put it all into her art, plumbing her depths. Laura half-heartedly tells her that her art is a fine example of plumbing.
Actually, I don't think that was in the script, though, was it? I mean, that wasn't in the episode. It was in the script, but I don't think it made it into the episode.
It's in the episode. It's definitely in the episode, yeah. Okay. Yeah. She goes on to say that she is free of Pitkin's prison. And I guess this shouldn't seem weird to me, but it does seem a little strange. She refers to her husband only by his last name. But I don't know. I guess Laura calls Mr. Steele Mr. Steele all the time, but they're not married and that there's a extenuating circumstances there. So,
right.
I don't know. That one felt weird.
Well, maybe that's how he liked to be referred to.
Could be. Yeah, that's true. My husband, when I met him, like his first name is Scott, but his friends all called him Hooksy because his last name is Hooks. And when I met him, it felt weird to call somebody by a nickname when you're just meeting them, because nicknames are usually given to, so I called him Scott, and apparently I was the only one that did. So, she says she paints what she wants whenever she wants, as long as she does so on Cliff's canvases. So this is the part that gets Laura's attention. And you can tell that she feels that she's made a mistake telling Laura that one, because Laura picks up on it right away. And she basically says to Joanne, she's like, so Cliff supplies the canvases? And she tells her off the record that he has a thing about shapes and dimensions. But every man has his kinks, right? She says at least his kinks are getting her on the art map, and that her ex-husband's kinks only ever got her carpool.
But we see no evidence of kids.
I just thought that too. We don't see any evidence of children in the house or anywhere in her life. And I guess she could be old enough to have grown children. Her hair is gray, but like I've got a crap ton of gray in my hair. Yeah. And I have a 7-year-old. So I don't know. It does seem weird that there's like no evidence whatsoever that any children ever existed. You'd think they'd put up a picture or something.
Yeah.
But nope. So we switch scenes. They're in the office. What is the thing that he's squeezing?
It's a hand exerciser.
Okay.
I don't know if I presume you can still get them. They probably aren't as popular as they used to be, but it's a very high tension mechanism. And as you squeeze it, you've got to use more and more strength to squeeze it, because it's really, really high tension. And so it builds up the muscle strength in your hands. And they've got different levels of them. As I recall, they had the ones that were much easier to squeeze, that you would start with, you know, when you're first starting out. And then as you got better at that one and it wasn't benefiting you nearly as much, you'd move up to the next level, which would give you more strength. And so it was a progressive thing. Why is it in the episode? I don't know.
Because like later,
and why does Laura grab it out of his hand and start?
She takes it
to squeeze it.
And then there's a scene in the episode later on where they both have one, and the thing that makes me question it is that nobody comments on it. It's never mentioned. It's just sort of there. And usually, when a prop is used or something is introduced like that, there's a purpose to it. It's either part of the joke or there's something to add to the episode with. There doesn't seem to be anything, and we never see them again in any other episode. So it seems kind of a weird thing to add that's not commented on or mentioned.
The only thing I can think of offhand is that the director wanted some other action going on in the scene because otherwise it was too stationary, and this is what they came up with in the moment.
It makes me think of that episode of I don't know if you ever saw the TV series 21 Jump Street, but towards the end of the show, like, Johnny Depp hated being on that show. It's well known that the minute he didn't even want to take the part because he had very strong feelings about police, and I'm not going to get into what they were, but he didn't want to take the part. He was playing a cop. He took it, and then that role essentially made him a pinup poster for, you know, girls, young girls everywhere. He became like a heartthrob, and he hated that too, I guess, and wanted off the show, but he was contracted to be on it. He couldn't just leave. And so he did increasingly like weird stuff on the set and when they were filming to basically try to get fired. And there's one episode where they're in the captain's office and they're talking about some sort of case that's taking place. And he's sitting there and his hair is gelled, like standing straight up in all kinds of crazy angles. And he's wearing this like really strange, bizarre outfit. Nobody comments on it. And then the scene just changes. Like, there's no mention of how weird he looks. And I read somewhere, and I could be making this up or remembering it wrong, but I read somewhere that he showed up on set that day like that. And they were just like, fine, screw it. We'll shoot the scene as is. So it kind of made me think of that, where it's like, it made me think of Johnny Depp sitting there looking extremely crazy and nobody comments on it. It just seemed like an odd visual aspect to the episode that is not doing anything for the plot, I guess.
Yeah. And like I said, the only reason I can think of it being included in there, other than it was a common thing at the time, maybe they got some company to pay him $50 to include it in there. But it was probably just the director saying, yeah, we need something else going on. And somebody grabs something and says, do this.
Yeah, fair enough. Could be it. So Laura is telling Steele what Joanne Pitkin told him about the shapes and sizes. She says, she told me she's just completed a 46 by 54, a 24 by 30, and a 60 by 20 that comes to a point at the top, which this piques his interest immediately, which Laura picks up on. He says that these were the dimensions of a panel stolen from the Bordeaux triptych. She grabs him and says, you didn't, to which he replies, of course not. Pause. I got there too late.
Yeah.
Oh, I love that. I just love it. And then she asks what it's worth. He says, to the right buyer, millions. And she comments and wonders who would want to pay millions for a stolen old master. She wonders about the thrill of sitting alone in a locked room looking at a painting you can't show anyone else. He says he's known people who have had an almost sexual pleasure having something that the rest of the world couldn't have, regardless of how secret they had to keep it. What movie does this make you think of off the top of your head?
A movie?
Yeah.
Thomas Crown.
Yeah. Yeah. It's in my notes. Like, the remake. I'm thinking specifically the remake, which obviously had not aired yet, but, or it hadn't been made yet, but. Because if I believe in the original, Thomas Crown steals money, does he not?
Correct.
Yeah. Yes, he does it for the thrill of it. He doesn't need the money, but he steals it anyway. But in the remake, he's stealing art specifically just because he wants to have it to look at it, knowing that nobody else can. And I just think this was kind of a cool statement in the episode for what Pierce would go on to later do with that remake, because that's... Mm-hmm. Yeah. A really good movie. So
it is.
Yeah. Just kind of made me think of Thomas Crown. Laura realizes that the Pitkins are a front in order to transfer old masters out of the country. So they figure out the game really quickly, which is important, I guess, for the rest of the episode.
Right.
All of a sudden the office buzzer thingy goes off, the phone, Laura picks up the phone, and somehow she knows that Richard, Richie is in the other room. She says, be gentle with him, Inspector Krebs, which is funny. obviously, she knows, like, they've obviously, there's got to be a scene that's missing or something that's happened in between the scene where she was at Joanne Pipkin's house and this scene, because clearly they've had enough time to look into Rick Richard Ritchie and find out that he is actually Helpful Harriet and not who he's pretending to be.
The only other possible explanation is that they knew he was coming in and Laura had instructed Mildred to buzz her when he arrived.
True. Yeah, that would work. But I just mean as well, they did some homework on him because... Right. And Mildred has obviously been the one to discover it because, yeah, she's saying, be gentle on him, Inspector Krebs, which is funny.
Yes.
You see him ask Mildred if they have something. And Mildred says she wants to ask a few questions first. He puffs up a bit and then deflates when Mildred asks him how to get a bourbon stain out of her living room carpet. Does Mildred strike you as a bourbon woman?
Not really, but
yeah,
you never know. I mean... Oh, who was it? It was there was some actress, like 40s or so actress, I think, who smoked cigars. You know,
that's fair.
To look at her, you wouldn't have thought, okay, she's a cigar smoker. So, yeah, I mean, you never know.
Yeah, fair enough. She then goes on to say she has a hole in a tweed skirt she would love to reweave, and then adds that her houseplants are just dying on the vine. You can tell by his expression, he knows he's caught.
Yeah.
He asks how she found him out. Mildred admits to going to the Tribune to check him out. He wonders what gave him away, and Mildred says, the trench coat. This is somewhat of an odd statement, as Laura and Steele wear trench coats all the time.
Yeah, but as we've talked about, they are stereotypically ridiculous.
Yeah, that's fair.
Real detectives don't wear trench coats. The only people who wear trench coats are people pretending to be detectives.
Yeah, true. Leo also wore a trench coat, so I guess that's a fair statement.
Pretending to be a detective.
Yep. Mildred also says the spill in Laura's office helped tip them off as well as the fact that Molly is an art critic, which led them to figuring out who he was. And who he is Helpful Harriet, the homemaker's friend. He writes an advice column for housewives. Yeah, go for it.
He says, Helpful Harriet, the homemaker's friend, the housewife's Kierkegaard.
Yeah.
And I had to look that up and because I didn't understand what that had to do with Helpful Harriet, the homemaker's friend. And so I looked it up and I still don't understand what it has to do with.
I don't get it either. I that's why I glossed over that line. I was just like, okay, I don't really know how Kierkegaard fits into this, but. Sure.
And for anybody who isn't familiar, Soren Kierkegaard was a Danish philosopher, a theologian, and a cultural critic who was a major influence on existentialism and Protestant theology in the 20th century. He attacked the literary, philosophical, and ecclesiastical establishments of his day for misrepresenting the highest task of human existence, namely becoming oneself in an ethical and religious sense. And he attacked it because they were saying it was as something so easy that it could be seemed to be already accomplished even when it had not been undertaken. So, I mean, it's all about religion and philosophy. What does that have to do with cleaning stains out of the carpet?
I don't know. I guess maybe if you're a homemaker and you're having an existentialist dilemma, I don't know.
To complicate it, the name Kierkegaard, translated, it means graveyard.
Yee. That's creepy.
So the housewife's graveyard? I suppose there are some women who would consider being a housebound wife as sort of being in a graveyard. But I mean, if that's the joke, what's the old saying? If you have to explain the joke, it's not a very good
one.
It's
not funny. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I'm with you on this one. That one went right over my head. So I didn't mention it.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's all. No. I thought maybe you knew something I didn't, so.
No. Turns out. And I still don't.
But it's interesting to have, because the show keeps doing this. It keeps giving us examples of people in non-traditional gender roles, either men in roles that are typically thought of as women's roles or vice versa, right? Because we've got Laura, who is she obviously the main character and sort of flipped the script. That's the whole point of the show. But then in the past we had, you know, in Etched in Steel, we had the books that were thought to have been written by this gorgeous Charlotte Knight were actually written by her kind of creepy looking husband. So in this case, we've got Clifford or Richard, sorry, who turns out to secretly be a guru on homemaking. And here's the thing. This is sort of a lost opportunity, I think. I don't know how they'd fit this in, but I would have liked to have seen more of the story revolve around his alter ego, but they kind of ignore it. Like, Mildred figures him out, and then that's sort of the end of it. And I don't know how they would have made it work, but it would have been kind of funny to see him use his homemaking talents to kind of help them solve the case somehow. Or I don't know. He just, it was, I think it made him more interesting that that's what he did for a living, and then it was sort of dropped. So
that could just be, I think he was designed to be basically just a caricature. And
yeah,
I don't think it went beyond that there, as far as they're thinking about the character. He's a caricature. He's there just to serve as a reason to get involved in the case. That's it. So
why do you think the show keeps coming back to these subtle examples, either through side characters or through, well, I mean, Laura herself? Like, do you think this is just all part of the mission statement of the show?
Well, I mean, the whole idea initially was that she was a woman in a role that was more traditionally thought of as being a man's role. And that they were wanting to turn the detective genre on its head through that. And so, yeah, I can see where they just naturally, they, the writers, the producers, everybody involved, just kind of, it just kind of absorbed that and used it as they were writing their stories. Plus, I mean, let's be honest. Those types of things have been going on for a long time. We talk about him being Helpful Harriet. I seem to recall that in real life, there were a number of these advice columns that were ghostwritten by men under women's names.
Oh, absolutely.
Names. So, so it's not, I guess what they're really doing is they're turning the stereotype and the stereotypes on their head, as opposed to the reality, because the reality was that there was already a bunch of this stuff going on.
Oh, for sure.
But,
absolutely.
But the perception wasn't there that this was going on. It was all underneath the cover, so to speak.
And I mean, they've done this too with Mildred, just in general, hiring an actress who's older and giving her this material to work with, which we don't typically see. And we've mentioned that before. So it is kind of in line with what they're doing just as a show. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of cool. Steel pops his head out of the doorway, gestures for Rick, who corrects them to Richie, to come back into the office. He confesses that he wanted to be an investigative reporter, and Molly knew that. So when she said she was on to something hot, he put up the money to bid on the Pitkin. Where would he get that kind of money? I doubt being Helpful Harriet pays that well. Or did he just save up?
I don't know. I mean, if he is a single person, which apparently he is, either that or he's trying to get a thing going on the side. But if he's single and he's got a reasonably well-paying job and he's not the kind of person who wastes his money or blows it on extravagances, which, I mean, look at the character. He's not going to be one of those. he could be saving some money. You know, he could have managed to get quite a bit of money stashed away simply because that's his personality or that's how he was raised to handle his money. And I don't know.
Kind of makes me think a little bit of Wilson.
Mm, yeah. He's okay.
Kind of that sort of typical caricature. Mm-hmm. Laura asks why she didn't tell him what was so hot. And he says, would you tell a wimp like me? Steele calls him Walker, to which he corrects him again, saying Richie, and it says it makes him feel clean again, which is kind of funny. He tells them that she was very interested in missing old masters and was going to write an article on them. So this sort of confirms what they already suspect. And poor Richie's confused, saying Joanne Pitkin is not an old master. And Laura replies that her work is very close to several of them, which is kind of funny. he gets really worried, poor Richie, and asks how deep Molly is into this, and he wonders if they've killed her. Steele points out that Conan wouldn't do anything irreversible until he gets what he wants. Laura adds that it's possible he's keeping her in the gallery. So that's when Richie jumps up and he says, let's storm the place. Not really the best idea. And yeah, so Steele responds that given the delicate nature of the mission, someone more experienced should go. Laura's response, you, in a tone that implies she doesn't trust his intentions. She pulls him into her office and accuses him of being awfully eager to get into that gallery. He protests that a woman's life is at stake, and she wonders if he's eager to get closer to the Bordeaux triptych, calling it the one that got away. He claims to be shocked, hurt, and appalled that she would entertain such a thought. She says that okay, well, then you wouldn't mind if I come with you. She says, acting as your backup, your lookout. And he finishes with, conscience?
Mm-hmm. Whatever you mean.
I mean, we know he's trying to get his hands on the triptych, but do we think at this point that his primary concern is Molly?
I think so. He might have a mixed motivation in that he wants to... Well, okay, a movie that comes up later.
Yeah.
In reference, Charade. There's one little scene in there, and it involves a seller of stamps. And one
We watched that one recently, actually.
The boy who is this the son of a friend of the lead character, the female character,
yeah,
goes to this market and he trades this stamp that he's got for a big packet of stamps, because he doesn't realize that the stamp's worth millions of dollars.
Yeah.
And when they trace down the stamp to this one guy, he says, look, you know, I know it was a mistake, but at least I got to hold it for a few moments. That's enough. And I think in a sense, maybe that's what Steele is thinking about when he's thinking about this triptych panel or the Bordeaux panel. I think he's maybe looking at it from that same perspective of, yeah, I know I can't steal it and keep it and sell it or anything like that, but at least I can get it in my hands and say, yes, I had it once.
I got to look at it, which makes sense given his feelings about art and whatnot. So I think Laura's offer to come into the gallery. He pretends to be offended, but there isn't the same level of animosity to either of them. I get the impression Laura's not nearly as suspicious of him as she was, and there's a certain level of affection in the way she teases him, which is kind of fun. I like that aspect of it. Her, well, are you sure it's not the Bordeaux triptych you want to get your hands on? Laura, I'm hurt. I'm appalled. It's cute the way that they're kind of teasing each other back and forth about this, rather than her saying, like, you just want to get that painting, and him being offended. So, yeah, I like it. We get a scene change. I have a couple of notes on this. Fred drops them off at the gallery. They're in their crime clothes. First question, why the heck did she choose to wear a skirt to do crime? That is the weirdest fashion choice. Like, she's got a long black skirt on over what looks to be tights or pants or something. Like, that's your crime outfit? It's not like this is your first time, Laura. You've done crime before. They have, like, a whole set in their closets of crime clothes. I'm pretty sure of it. When they were all blacked, and, you know. Also, Fred has to know, right? He has to know. Like, they're in their crime clothes. He tells Fred to come back in 20 minutes and try to look inconspicuous.
In a limousine.
In a limousine.
In this area of town.
Yeah, in a limousine. Like, but here's, like, Fred, I got an, and this is a fan fiction. If anybody wants to write this, A Day in the Life of Fred, I would love to know what's going on in his head when he drops him off in these places. Like, he's got to be thinking, oh, God, they're doing crime again. Oh, okay. Like, they better hope he never writes memoirs.
Yes, yes.
Like, Friday night, I dropped Mr. Steele and Laura off at the magazine, or at the gallery, dressed all in black. Can't imagine what they were doing. Like, I don't know. It just, this was kind of funny. So We got that. Using a rope and a pulley system, he manages to scale the wall where he finds what looks to be, is it a fuse box? Is that what he's doing?
Yeah, you know, I've got some real serious issues with this entire sequence.
Okay.
First of all, shooting a grappling hook onto a roof to secure a climbing rope. You know, this is a popular thing to do in TV shows and movies, and I cringe.
Media all the time. Yep.
I cringe because I'm sorry, that's not quiet.
No.
You've got the sound of the charge or the compressed air coming out, shooting that grappling hook out. You got the sound of it hitting whatever it is that it hits. And then, of course, what does it hang on to? What is it that they're using to pull themselves up with? A rain gutter?
Yeah.
I mean, again, that's another thing that is done a lot in TV shows and movies. They get this hook, they hook it up to a rain gutter, and that's not going to hold you.
In Canada, we call them eaves troughs, but yes, I agree.
I mean, they're lightweight metal. They're just nailed into the fascia board. Yeah. It's not going to stay.
It'd crumple. It would pull out, and then you'd have this like, yeah, you have to fix it.
Yeah, even if you got 3 feet up off the ground before it collapsed, it was going to collapse and drop you. And then, like, the security system control box on the outside of the building?
That doesn't make any sense either. And that high up, it like, you'd have to have a ladder. If you're not doing crime, you'd have to have a ladder or something to get you up there, which is a weird spot to put it.
You don't put something like that on the outside where it's accessible.
No,
you put it on the inside where it's actually protected by the system that it's controlling. Yeah. You know, it reminds me a lot. Years ago, I used to do pizza delivery for Pizza Hut. And
I used to work for Pizza Hut, too. It's kind of funny. Not delivering. I worked in the restaurant, but yeah.
Well, this location that I was working out of was strictly delivery, which at the time, you know, they did still have the restaurants. Now they don't. But they had this security system in the store. So they had this camera sitting near the ceiling, pointing down, recording everybody that came in and went out. And on the front counter, they had the cash register and the video recorder that the camera was recording to. So, you know, it's like, what? And I even commented to them. I said, guys, if somebody's going to come in and rob the place, they're going to see the camera. They're going to see the video recorder.
Yeah,
they're just going to take the tape. You've got nothing. Yeah. Where's the security in that? I mean, that's what this reminds me of here is we've got the security alarm system. Yeah, that the crook can turn off.
Actually, it makes me think of, I used to work at a department store called Zeller's. It doesn't exist anymore, but our store was so crappy that we didn't even have a security system, but we pretended we did. So every now and then it was somebody's job, literally somebody's job, to go on the speaker system and say, security camera scan section 2, security camera scan section 2. And we would do that throughout the entire day. We'd make random security scan pages so that people thought we had cameras. We had no cameras. There were no cameras in that store. So. I'm not divulging any secrets here since the chain shockingly folded, but yes.
Well, you know, that reminds me of something I read somewhere, or maybe it was something I thought of myself, you know, where people have these stickers, my home protected by ADT security systems. And the sticker's the best security system there is.
Exactly.
$0.50 a piece, you know?
That or a beware of dog sign, you know? Yeah. You're good to go. So, anyway. he pulls the fuse out, I guess, or whatever that is.
Something.
Yeah, and he then tells Laura, who's waiting below, to try the door. This is, I will say, this is their third heist together, and that's important. I'm going to bring that up later. But Laura seems far more confident in what she's doing. And they seem to work together rather well. It's interesting, though, that he has them put ski masks on when they didn't, for when they stole the 5 Nudes of Cairo and when they broke into the Federal Reserve Bank in season 1. You'd think they would have.
Well, and then I was going to bring this up because later on in the
crime,
they
don't use them. Yeah.
They take them off. They were wearing them because they thought they might be on camera.
Yeah.
And Yeah, when the bad guys are looking for them, they take them off. Yeah, it just makes no sense.
Yeah.
Why bother wearing them in the first place if you're going to take them off later? I mean, it's just...
I mean, she's got a skirt on, so that just makes things look even weirder, in my opinion. But so she picks the lock. She manages not to set off the alarm. She's about to go in. That's when he hands her the ski mask, says they might be on candid camera. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that's weird. We see them sneak in, and as they do, the camera does cut to a small room where the two henchmen are sitting there with TVs watching the security footage, and they see the two of them coming inside and going up the stairs. So they grab guns and go after them. They enter a room and find the chair that Molly was tied to with her number for the auction below it, but no Molly. So they assume that she's been moved, but before they can do anything, they hear a noise. Laura sees the two henchmen coming towards the room. They hide behind the door, and when the men enter, one shoots the gun. Steele pushes a cabinet over it. It falls on top of them, and they run out. This is where they take the masks off, I think, right? This is where they...
Yeah.
So then we get a scene change. They've been searching a while. They haven't found anything. Steele wants to leave, saying they've searched every room in the gallery, but Laura is convinced that Conant must be sitting on something to have those two men on at night. Wouldn't any place like that have security?
Well... You would think so. At least, on the other hand, you know, if they've got a good alarm system, which obviously they don't.
They don't. But let's presume that they did.
But let's presume that they did, or they thought they did. Then you might go without actual security people. But or what you might do is you would have an alarm on the building, and then maybe hire a security company to come by and do security checks. Okay, are all the windows intact? Nobody's broken in that way. Okay, yeah, it looks all good. You know, and they write on their little report, okay, we checked this address at such and such time. No issues, you know, noted. So they might have had some sort of a system there that involved people, but not necessarily on the inside. But you never know.
Fair enough. Yeah.
You never know.
I just figured with like a gallery that's so supposedly so prestigious and has like important works of art in it, that would warrant an actual security guard, at least one.
Yeah, but, you would think so. And that would be my expectation.
Yeah.
But maybe they knew the Conant Gallery well enough to know that they didn't normally have somebody there. I don't know.
That's true.
I mean, after all, Laura does seem to have some familiarity with gallery, as evidenced by her comments earlier in the episode. So
Yeah, she's aware of who they are and what they do. So that makes sense.
I guess if you have to work this hard to explain the inconsistencies, there's an issue. Yeah, it's not that funny a joke. Fair. Yeah.
Yeah. Laura then gets it into her head to take the Pipkins. Steele wonders what happened to her conscience. She starts looking for the paintings, while Steele comments that he's been trying to lead her astray, but this was not the direction he had in mind. And then she exclaims, "The bathroom," to which he replies, "I know you're excited, but can't you wait until we get home?" And of course, that's when she says he's got to look at something. And sure enough, the paintings are in the bathroom. He makes a comment about a critical. he says something like, "This is a critical comment being made," when she hands him the paintings that they're in the bathroom. But yeah, I think we all know what that comment would be. And they leave, and then we're back. And at Steele's apartment, Laura is popping champagne. She's singing "You and the Night and the Music," which, as she gets them a glass, this is the biggest issue I have with the episode.
Okay,
this is the thing I wanted to point out. We know that they've broken into two places previous where they've, you know, dressed up in their crime clothes and done the whole bit. This is not the first heist that she's been involved with.
And I know where you're going with this.
Yeah.
I know which line you're going to go to.
Yeah. Well, it's not even a line. It's just her excitement, the thrill that she's experiencing throughout the rest of this episode. It's supposed to be amusing, but for some reason it triggers that secondhand embarrassment for me to watch it.
Mm-hmm.
I know I'm supposed to find it funny. I know where the writers were going and what they wanted out of this. And Stephanie is fantastic. She's singing, she's popping champagne, she's all over Mr. Steele while he's trying to get the paintings out of the frames. I just cringe every time I watch it. I don't know why, but her behavior seems just so, I don't know, like juvenile almost. And he's irritated with her, which makes me embarrassed for her. And I don't know.
And the whole thing is summed up in the one line. The whole thing is summed up in the one line that says, Mr. Steele's opened up a whole new aspect of our work for me.
Yeah. Because there it is.
This is not new. This is not new. They've done it before. They did it back in the first season.
Yeah.
Twice. At least twice. When they broke into the museum.
The Five Years of also Cairo. Yeah.
And when they broke into the Federal Reserve. Yeah. So
both heists were dangerous. Both heists allowed Steele to showcase his talents, Laura to learn about his ability to break into heavily guarded places. Like at one point he needed a spear gun for the Five Nudes of Cairo one. So it just I don't know. It feels very it's the same thing I didn't like about the Sam Spade shtick that he pulled in, you know, in that other episode, the high flying or steel flying or whatever it is. I watch it and I cringe. And I know I shouldn't.
You know, in some ways, it's almost like there were two issues going on. One being that the writers didn't go back and look at the previous episodes to see what had been done, to see if they were backtracking on something. And that second, the production team didn't have a continuity editor to catch these things and say, look, no, we've already done this. This is out of sequence. This, you know, this makes no sense in the context of everything that's come before. We need to change this and make it work for where these characters are right now.
Yeah, I agree. Because this would have worked really well in season one. This would have worked really well in Thou Shalt Not Steal. It would have been hilarious. Her just because she's already intrigued by him when they do that heist where he's got the little monsters and he brings the whiskey with him and he has the whole like that would have been. This just feels weird because she's done this twice. She knows. I don't know. And then he's pulling the canvases off to find first a Rembrandt stolen from a Belgian museum. She points out that he must have a whole museum in that gallery, and Steele says, I'd call this a fair night's work. She says, fair, I'd call it fantastic. And the other issue that I have here is that there's still a woman missing. And she seems more into the thrill of the break-in than the fact that there's a woman's life that is at stake, which is
It's like she's forgotten that the purpose of the break-in was to get the painting so that they could free the person who's being held. And, well, now we've got the paintings. We've won.
And Richie is weirded out at this point. He points out that she seems awfully up about things. And that's where she comes out with that line of Mr. Steele having opened up a whole new aspect of the work. And he's like, stealing? And that she goes, I think, purloining. And I'm just like, And then Richie asks if she should be so happy about it since she's a private detective. And she says eventually everything becomes predictable. Find a body, find some clues, find a killer. And Steele mutters that by lunch they're watching the clock like everyone else as he pulls off another canvas to reveal a Monet taken from a private collection of a Parisian banker. This is, again, I think the thing that adds to this cringe factor for me is that he's unimpressed by Laura's antics, which makes it even more embarrassing. She's kind of like an errant child that he's sort of swatting away as he's trying to do the work that they're there to do. It doesn't work for me. So he mentions that they'll need a top-notch forger for this, saying that he isn't planning on handing the originals back to Conant. He wagers there'll be a hefty finder's fee, to which Laura adds, Mr. Steele is very big on finder's fees. I did like this line.
it's a nice callback. It was a good one. Yes.
Yeah. Especially since he never seems to get them. And this happens in this episode too. And this, again, Richie is even more concerned because he was under the impression they were going to trade the paintings for Molly. He thinks it might be dangerous to palm fakes off on a man like Conant, adding, not that I'm a coward. And Laura says she understands, but he decides to take a walk to clear his head as Steele pulls the last canvas off. As he does so, she says that she understands why he did what he did while she's, you know, kissing his neck. And again, he's trying to work here. Like, it's
inappropriate timing.
It's really, he's barely paying attention, saying that this is painstaking enough without that sort of distraction. She keeps going on about the incredible rush as he reveals the last painting to be the Bordeaux panel. this is the part where he kind of perks up. He picks it up, he looks at it, and he says, "I finally feel as if I'm holding a woman I've been after all my life." Ouch! Right in front of Laura. And Laura mentions that Conan is giving a party for Joanne Pitkin tomorrow and that she's been invited, noting that they stole his appetizers. He replies that it sounds like the perfect place for a swap meet. Here's another question I have.
Okay.
We find out later on these are fakes. So This becomes a moot point. But they're supposedly going to swap or try to get somebody to forge these paintings. Are they expecting that to happen in a day? Or, like, it would take a while, I would assume.
Yeah.
For anyone to replicate three very different paintings by very different artists. Like,
yeah. Well, and it's not just a matter of, okay, I've got the canvas, I got the paint. Yeah, give me 24 hours and I'll just whip this painting out. Because, well, first of all, they have to let the paint dry.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it has to be dry enough. I mean, obviously, anybody who knows anything about paints knows that, you know, there's different levels of dry.
Yeah.
But it has to be dry enough that they can age them properly.
Yeah.
You don't do that in the paint. You do that to the paint and to the canvas. And yeah, there's no way.
Yeah, no. Not even a top-notch forger could make it believable in that short of a time span. Mm-hmm. So, but no. She is impressed by his, quote, boldness and suggests that he hold another woman that he's been waiting for. And he finally responds to her advances. They start making out on the couch. Also awkward because, of course, Richie walks in.
Mom, Dad, what are you doing?
Yeah, continuing the tradition of them getting interrupted by someone, Richie comes in and says he's not a coward, just overly cautious. So, yeah. poor Mr. Steele. Yeah. We get a scene change. A man named Lewis Grummond is in the office waiting for Laura. He asks Mildred why she asked to see him, and then asks if she's been getting calls about him. Mildred says no and asks if she should know who he is. Mildred has no idea. No. Laura comes in, still singing the song, and says it's nice to see him. He seems surprised and asks her if she means that. So this is I like this. This is a cute exchange because I kind of wish Mr. Grummond appeared again because I really kind of liked his character. He's appropriately nervous and sort of suspicious, especially with Laura being so kind to him, which I guess is unique. Goes into her office.
Obviously she busted him, so
so and that's I guess one of my questions is that she's not a cop, so would she still be getting his probation reports?
You wouldn't normally think so.
Wouldn't they go to, like, she as a private investigator, you would think her job would merely be to turn him over to the authorities and they would make the arrest. So theoretically,
unless during the course of whatever investigation this was and the revelation of him being the criminal, that somehow during the course of this, they became acquainted to the level where Laura took an interest in him and his success.
That's fair.
As as somebody going straight. And so that would maybe explain her interest in him beyond the point where the investigation was concluded. But wouldn't you think that she would just pick up the phone and call him?
You would think.
Hey, how are you doing?
Yeah. I guess maybe she wanted to show him the paintings in person.
She would call him and talk to him and say, "Hey, Lewis, how you doing?" Instead of getting reports from his probation officer.
Well, that's true. Yeah, I guess we're just supposed to, that line is there to tell us who he is, and it's shorthand, right? But
hand wave.
Yeah, so he comes into her office, says that he doesn't know what she's heard, but he's straight. He goes to work every day from 9 to 6, and he sort of stumbles over this next part of it because you can tell he hates his job at a greeting card company. And that would be
drawing those cutesy little illustrations.
I gotta say, I stopped, but my husband and I have stopped buying each other cards, A, because they're pointless. You end up just recycling them anyway. And B, because they never have anything on them that in any way reflects our personalities. I've noticed that they lean very heavily into specific stereotypes, right? The cards for husbands are always like jokes about beer and women and golf and sports and whatever. They think men are, and I'm sure there's a lot of men that are interested in those things. It's just, there's none with jokes about Marvel characters or science fiction or Babylon 5 or, you know, any of that stuff. So, and then the women's ones are always like very beautiful script with like the most schmaltzy, cheesy phrases on them in the world. And I would just throw up if I received a card like that. So
it's like when you were in grade school and you got Valentine's Day cards for all the kids in the classroom, just because you had to get Valentine's Day cards for kids in the classroom. Yeah.
And if you were like me, who was like the most unpopular kid in the class, like the kid that everybody made fun of, getting all those cards was a adding insult to injury, because you knew that the only reason they were giving them to you is because they had to, because their parents told them to.
That's right. No, I was that same person.
So yeah, woo, nerds unite. Anyway, so yeah, he hates his job at a greeting card company, and he says he's straight. And so then she goes on to ask if she can bend him just a little. He seems suspicious of this, and she says she won't even try to explain. The picture's worth a thousand words. She turns the Pitkins around so that Lewis can see the other side, and he's in complete awe. He sits down, he looks at them for a few minutes, and then he says, do you have any, he asks if she has any idea what he's feeling. He goes on to describe being in the presence of genius. Laura says she wouldn't ask him if it wasn't a matter of life and death, but can he reproduce them? And this is where he says,
surprised.
Why would I want to reproduce them? These are three of the finest forgeries I've ever seen. So that's where the record scratch happens, right? Like, wait a minute, what? What? this is not good, because Steele has already gone to the party.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. And we see, we probably should have coordinated this, but, you know, whatever. At the party, Joanne Pitkin, she's laughing, she's schmoozing among the guests, saying, I paint what I feel, and I feel what I paint. Okay. Okay, Joanne. Sure, we'll put that on a greeting card, because that's the exact kind of pointless crap that would go on one.
Yes.
Cliff Conant does not look happy. He walks over to the treacherous trio from the auction. Mr. Schneiderman comments that he doesn't see his Pitkin, and the others chime in. Theirs aren't there either. And then he says there are Pitkins for the peasants and Pitkins for the connoisseurs. Okay. After tomorrow's auction, he promises the paintings will be safe in their hands. Steele comes in with Richie. He sees them. Monica makes another comment about the man who died in Venice, saying that he died so badly she could barely finish her dinner.
I mean, you know,
oh my God. Okay. What did she do to him? Like, we get the impression that he drowned at first, but like, did she?
Yeah. It was more than that.
Yikes. There's a fan fiction I don't want. Give me The Adventures of Fred or The Adventures of Nero, but I really don't want to know what happened in Venice. Good. Conant excuses himself and approaches Mr. Steele. He comments that he didn't recall inviting him and that he has a habit of going where he isn't wanted. Steele introduces Richie, and Conant says there is nothing there for them, very pointedly. Steele says he brought his own exhibit and hands him photos of the Pitkins that they stole. He, Laura, and Richie are each in the photos, making them look really bizarre selfies. Like, really strange. like, those are weird pictures. The expressions on their face, it's just odd.
It doesn't help that they're Polaroids, you know.
Because.
And they're, they're bad lighting and everything. So, yeah.
It's just a funny... Yeah, they're funny pictures. So Conant says he has no idea that he was such a resourceful collector. And Steele says he will trade them for Molly Donovan. Conant says it's a trade he would be more than willing to make if he knew where she was, and then says he's going to find a security guard to help them out after Richie almost attacks him for lying. Steele suggests they light a fire under him by stealing his buyers as well as the old masters. Not a good idea because they don't have the real paintings, but
yeah.
Richie says that the more he's around Mr. Steele Lalore, the more he hates being a coward. And Steele suggests they work the room, approaches Mr. Schneiderman, who identifies himself, who as a man who buys for European collectors, or sorry, Steele identifies him as a man who buys for European collectors as well as writes books about the Renaissance. Steele then identifies Steele then identifies the Asian man as Koji Asuda, who works the Far East. Nobody is quite sure how he gets what he's after, but he never comes back empty-handed. And finally, we have Monica Haddon, who represents certain eccentric English collectors, and who once said that murder is the only true erotic experience. How does he know that?
Obviously, he's come across her before.
Well, I mean, yes, because we know that because of Venice. It was Venice, but like...
Right. You know, I guess these kinds of things just... get known.
Yeah. Well, especially since she's so fond of telling the story at every party she goes to.
Yeah. Hey, it's PR, you know?
Yeah, I suppose. So, yeah. She asks if they've met. Steele says not officially, but they almost ran into each other in Venice. He reveals the young man with the Rubens was on his way to see him when he lost his footing and disappeared in a canal. So, yeah. Mr. Schneiderman asks what Steele is doing there, and he tells him the same thing that the others are, an insatiable craving for Pitkins. Right. Monica says they have all the Pitkins they need, and Steele hands him the Polaroid, saying that those are from Mr. Conant's private collection. So this is, Laura runs down the stairs. She sees that Mr. Steele has handed them the photos. She runs off. Monica is angry and says that they've already paid Conant a substantial deposit. Laura's still trying to get his attention. Yeah. She's trying to get to Steele. She's pulled aside by Joanne and introduced to someone as being from Art Insight. He tries to tell her that he loved an article on the Ashcan School and says that she may be researching there any minute before running off. She's just trying to get away. Mm-hmm. Steele is telling them that he isn't greedy and that all he wants is the rest of the money that they were going to pay Conant. And she's behind them, like trying desperately to get his attention, telling him to stop. But he either doesn't see her or does not care. So he tells them to meet at his apartment later that night. Monica says, let's hope this goes better than Venice for all concerned. She's really just,
she loves that story.
Yeah, she's working that thing to death. Mm-hmm. Pardon the pun. That's her,
that's her claim to fame. She's going to milk it for
Laura
all it's worth.
Laura runs up, says, tell me you didn't offer them the paintings. Richie says that he was brilliant, had them eating out of the palm of his hand. Steele adds that they practically devoured the bait. And of course, Laura moans that that's not all they're going to devour and tells him that her foray into burglaring netted them 3 forgeries.
Mm-hmm. Oof. Ouch.
Yeah.
What's that old saying? Don't count your chickens before they hatch.
Steele and Richie are shocked. They look over at Conant, and he's sipping champagne and smiling kind of smugly at him. So he clearly knows that they have the wrong paintings. Scene change. And here's what I wrote in my notes, because I did not know what this thing was before you told me what it was. I wrote, now they both have a squeezy thing. Because, I had no idea what it was. So yeah,
and she is trying so hard to squeeze that thing and it's failing so badly.
Yep. Steele says that Conant has Molly and has them selling forgeries to 3 people who would kill them to keep their reputations intact. Laura wonders how he could possibly plan to pass off 3 forgeries to experts like Schneiderman, and Steele suspects he planned to show them the originals and then ship the copies, which Laura is irritated by because it means Conant gets to keep the originals in his own locked room. Here's my question. Wouldn't the 3 eventually figure it out and realize they've been duped and go after Conant?
Probably. Well, especially if their clients realized that they were fakes.
Yeah.
But perhaps if their clients didn't realize that they were fakes, the treacherous trio would be kind of off the hook in that respect. They would probably come to Conant and demand a piece of the action upon threat of visiting Venice, but
yeah.
But they might not jump straight to
the canal.
Walk along the canals. Yeah.
Fair. Okay. Yeah.
But yeah, it's certainly risky on Conan's part.
It's very risky.
Which is I don't know if that's a brilliant plan of his that he's created or not, because everything he's done up to this point has been kinda totally dumb. Incompetent and yeah. poorly thought out.
Yeah. He's not the best villain he's definitely not the best villain we've had. He was no. much better as a high school principal chasing down Matthew Broderick.
Okay.
Laura says that if they're going to save Molly's skin, not to mention their own, they have to find the originals, and eagerly suggests knocking over the gallery again. Yeah, okay. Outside, Richie asks Mildred what's taking them so long, and Mildred says, oh yeah, this is where they're at their best when working a case. Cool, logical, professional manner. And inside the office, we hear Steele yell, have you gone berserk? To which Laura replies, well, you haven't come up with anything. He says he doesn't want to dim her newfound passion for thieving, but Conan is much too smart to keep the originals in his gallery after their previous visit, which is very, very true, very smart.
Actually, I would disagree.
Yeah, well, true, but like he's assuming a level of intelligence that's not there.
Well, I'm going to disagree with that, because if somebody's already looked somewhere for something and they didn't find it,
yeah,
that's the best place to put it. Really?
That's true.
Because yes, they've absolutely. Already looked there, and their yep. natural thought process is going to be, it's got to be somewhere else.
Yeah, so, that's I mean, true.
Anyway.
Richie says that he wishes he and Molly were back at the Tribune in his little cubicle or whatever. He says the work was dull and pointless, but at least it was safe, and that he would give anything to be eating stale sandwiches from a vending machine while putting anonymous complaints in the suggestion box.
Yeah.
Okay. It's not really the life of the rich and famous, so you can kind of understand why he craved a little excitement. He's rather bitter at this point at his desire for adventure. And Mildred assures him that everyone's entitled to new horizons. She says she wasn't always a hard-bitten dick ready to lay her life on the line for $100 a day plus expenses.
She's still back at Altered Steel doing her Sam Spade bit.
But also, that's good money they're paying her. In 1983, $100 a day plus expenses? It's not nothing.
No, it's not. I mean, like, it would be pretty good, yeah.
$500 a week, right? So that'd be $2,000 a month. Like, that's good money.
Yeah, that was decent money, yeah. But, you know, the thing is, a good secretary is worth a lot of money.
That's true, yeah. And she says she seized her destiny and ran with it. Richie bitterly says he will do that when Molly's safe. Mildred then assures him that the silence from the office means that the boss has got it. Meanwhile, Laura is asking him for an old movie to put things in perspective. This is important because it shows that she's coming to rely on his rather unconventional instincts, and he can't seem to come up with them. So that's kind of
funny. That's not good.
No, he's got no movie. Laura points out that Conan has 3 pictures worth millions. She asks, where would he keep them where they were accessible, but nobody would think to look? She suggests his bank vault or a wine cellar. Steele kind of sarcastically adds his gym locker. Laura then references Charade and says the paintings have been under her nose the whole time. He comments that her nose has been in far more interesting places than his. And it's important to point out that all of the film references in this episode are made by her, which is new.
Yeah.
Laura asks where the safest place to look for something up and answers by saying, prison. Steele is very confused.
Yes. Wasn't there for that conversation.
No. They arrive at Joanne Pitkin's house. Laura suggests they try a window, but Steele suggests they try the front door. And that she is still from Art Insight. He's her editor. They need to borrow the paintings. This would make perfect sense.
Yes.
It's clear that Joanne Pitkin has no idea what her paintings are being used for. So, I mean, she's still under the delusion she's an artist. So this would have been a perfect way to get their hands on the paintings. But, of course, Laura has indeed gone berserk.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. So it's a great idea, except she snuck away to go through the window. as Joanne answers the door. Steele apologizes for disturbing the creative process. She perks up the moment he mentions Laura and asks if she's there, to which Steele replies that she's around and about, because yes, he notices that she's gone. He introduces himself as Adam Canfield, the editor.
And which she is another Vince. Reference.
Yeah. Actually, so I guess he does kind of make a reference, sort of.
Yeah. So for anybody who hasn't seen the movie Charade, that is one of the names that Cary Grant's character uses during the course of the movie. Yes. So.
But you could, I guess, argue that Laura's already made the Charade reference, so he's just going along with it. Yes. She invites him in and immediately starts flirting with him. A thud can be heard from somewhere, to which Steele writes it off as an earthquake. She tries to get him to come into her studio, and when he asks, and then he asks her to tell him about her work instead, as another thud is heard. She's now convinced someone is in the studio, but before she can investigate, the doorbell rings. He tells her to get the door while he checks the studio, and it's Conan's henchmen. They've come for the Pitkins, Miss Pitkin.
Yeah.
Steele goes into the studio to find Laura there. She has two, but she hasn't found the third. They search for it, but the henchmen run in. Steele shoves a canvas through their faces as he grabs the final painting and they run out the door. Joanne Pitkin seems upset at first and then elated. Yes. She's been stolen. I made the big time. Oh, God, that poor woman. Yeah.
Fueling her delusion.
That poor delusional woman.
But she feels good about it.
She does. She feels great. She's like, I've made the big time. I've been stolen. So, yeah. They jump into the rabbit as the henchmen chase them. They shoot at them. Wouldn't this potentially mean hitting the paintings? Like,
Yeah.
That they're obviously not the smartest henchmen either. They drive away. Steele says that she has gone berserk. Laura is still sort of cackling maniacally. She doesn't know what's come over her. She describes it as an aberration, like eating jelly beans or buying Chinese cookbooks. Huh?
You know, for some people, eating jelly beans is not an aberration.
Yeah, they're delicious. But
apparently it is for her.
Why would you not want jelly? Like, if I see jelly beans, I don't
like jelly beans. I don't like jelly beans, but.
You're the aberration.
That's me. You know, for somebody who likes jelly beans, it's not an aberration.
Yeah, it's, or buying China, like, I, yeah. She says she's sure, she's positive it will pass. She goes on to ask him if this is how it used to feel, and describes it as skin tingling, heart pounding excitement. He says at first, but eventually you get used to it. And she says that's sad. And he adds that it's not all thrills and tingles. There's the very real possibility of getting caught. And again, this is the... She says, there's one positive aspect to this that I can truly relate to your former profession. But you... I don't know.
Yeah. Well, you know, Steele's response...
Third time's a charm?
Steele's like, response about how, you know, you feel that way at first, but it wears off, is really kind of the serious version of Laura's earlier flippant comment.
Find the body, find the killer,
Exactly. But it's an interesting commentary on how easily we as humans can get bored with routine.
Yeah, it depends. Doesn't really matter what the routine is. Like, yeah.
And having something that changes the routine, something that gives us some excitement, sucks us in, and we go into it full bore, gung-ho, and then it becomes routine.
Yeah.
And we go to something else. So, yeah.
Well, it's like anybody with ADHD when we pick up a new hobby, right? You have a tennis racket. All of a sudden, you're going to play tennis every day. And then, you know, a week later, that tennis racket is shoved in the back of a closet somewhere and is never heard from again. So, yeah.
You are describing my life.
Yeah, well, it's mine too. So, there we go. But yeah, he looks back. He sees the car is still following them. Laura asks what he's thinking. He says, now they know they have the real paintings, they might as well let them have them. Laura obviously catches on to this idea, says that he is one hell of a partner in crime, and we get the scene change. They run into Steele's apartment with the paintings, past Richie, into the bedroom where they swap the old masters for the forgeries, in with the old, out with the new. Richie's standing there baffled watching them, and asks them what they're doing. Laura tells them to be cool as they are about to reenact one of Mr. Steele's favorite movies, The Sting. And it's interesting to note, again, that this is a film reference made by her. He's impressed by it. He kind of gives her a look. Hey, wait a minute. Yeah, you know that. The doorbell rings. Laura asks who it is, knowing full well, as one henchman drops in via the window and the other comes through the door. They have guns. They demand the Pitkins. Laura and Steele allow them to take the fakes and they leave. So I guess this is just further evidence that Steele's apartment is not that high up because people seem to sneak in all the time.
Yep.
Also, his security is terrible. So we just you'd think that
being a private detective, he'd have some sort of security system installed in his apartment.
One would think, and yet here we are. So we get a scene change. We see Conant authenticating the fake Pitkins, realizing that they're the forgeries. And at the same time, Mr. Schneiderman is doing so for the real paintings in the apartment. Steele tells him he will put them back in their Pitkins canvas and bring them to the auction. Schneiderman seems a little surprised by this, and Steele smoothly tells him that he has struck a deal with Conant, pointing out that they want their Pitkins authenticated. Monica Haddon seems thrilled with the concept of playing out the charade, which, again, goes with the
movie reference, yes.
Meanwhile, Conant storms into another room where Molly's being held and tells her that they brought her to the gallery for a special reason. She's going to make a phone call, most important call of her life. So we get that element. We switch there to the scene at the auction. Laura and Steele have come in. Laura says that as soon as they have their Pitkins, they will hit Conant with the sad news that he sold them all fakes. Again, wasn't that always his plan? Like,
but yeah,
that was an odd line. I found that an odd line.
He was going to sell them the fakes, but he knew that he was going to sell them the fakes, and he was going to be keeping the originals. And this is kind of convoluted.
And then Steele adds that when he coughs up Molly, they will inform the treacherous trio of his deception. And Laura basically says, I think we're finally on top of this one, which of course never works out well for anybody when you make a statement like that. Steele adds that all they have to do now is collect their finder's fee. Still on that finder's fee. He says that, as he says that, they look over to see a very guilty looking Richie appear. Laura assumes the worst and they ask him what he's doing there. He tells them that he settled everything and freed Molly by giving Conant the real Pitkins. Oh no. Laura and Steele are devastated by this. Steele tells Harriet that was not helpful. Which is a nice line. I like that one.
Yeah.
Conant comes out of the background. He's watching them with that smug smirk that Jeffrey Jones is really good at. Mm-hmm. Richie tells them he got a call from Molly and Conant got on the phone and offered to let her go. He claims that it was Mildred's advice to seize the moment that led him to do it. Which, Loris, we have to have a talk with Mildred about her little pep talks, which I like how she says that. Laura seems surprised that she is in the building and Steele demands to know where she is. Unfortunately, Richie isn't sure. He says all he knows is that they're in a room with statues and paintings. Steele asks if there was a statue without a head and Richie says there was and it was very unique. So they obviously know what room they're in. They go to leave, but not before saying their farewells first. They approach Conant. They tell him they're leaving. He asks if they're going to stay for the auction, and Laura says they have nothing left to offer, and Conant agrees, and they take Richie and leave. Again, I don't know why they felt the need to say goodbye to him. Like,
I guess just to let him know that they're on their way out.
Yeah, I guess. They split up. Steele takes Richie down the staircase. Laura goes up one. Steele tells her to get Molly while he gets the Pitkins. She finds Molly and unties her, telling her she's with Richie. Meanwhile, Steele and Richie enter Conant's office. Richie asks how he knows they're here. Steele says he doesn't know, but he has to start somewhere as he goes into the bathroom to find three paintings. Steele comments on how it's rather ingenious hiding place, asking who would think to look there a second time, as you've already pointed this out. So, yeah, I guess it's... Except Steele did look there a second time, so...
Yeah.
Maybe.
Well, there's always a flaw in every plan.
They grab the paintings. Meanwhile, Laura and Molly are leaving. She notices three Pitkins in the corner of that room. Steele and Richie run in And he and Molly are untied. It's then that they realize that they both have sets of paintings and they don't know which ones are real and which ones are fakes. Conant then arrives with his henchmen, saying Steele's persistence has become irritating. Before they can shoot, however, Richie, this is a bit of a complicated scene. So Richie knocks over a glass vase, I think, and Steele hits one of the henchmen. A fight ensues. Laura uses a piano to knock the gun out of the other henchman's hands. Molly lifts a Pitkin to hit him with it, which Steele yells, "No, not with that," which is kind of funny. One of the men is attacking Richie. She goes over and attempts to hit him. He gets thrown across the room by Richie, and Steele manages to punch the guy attacking Laura. So they come together, they toss the henchmen over the stairs and frantically grab at the paintings. They decide to take them all. Conant intervenes, saying he's got three people downstairs waiting for their Pitkins. Here's what I don't understand. Why not just say tough luck and take them anyway? Like, Conan doesn't have a gun.
I guess. Good question.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, yeah.
Like, there's three of them and one of him. Four of them, sorry.
I guess the only reason would be that if they did that, then the treacherous trio would perhaps be coming after them. And that by letting Conant have the three to pass along to the henchmen, or the terrible trio, if they get the wrong ones and they realize it, then they're going to come after him, not after Steele, I guess. Yeah.
Laura then tells him to pick a set. Conant protests they all look alike. She says he's the art expert, and Steele says we each have a 50% chance of getting what we want, and they frantically grab at the paintings. So, you know, and this is also where he says, I lost my finder's fee in Acapulco. I'm not repeating the same experience. Unfortunately, we have a scene change. Three paintings are in the office. Grumman declares them to be fakes. So, yeah. And what are the odds?
My question.
I'll let you ask it, because I have a feeling it's the exact same thing I was going to ask. So you go ahead.
What's the chance that Conant got all three of the genuine paintings and Laura and Steele got all three of the fakes?
My words were, what were the odds they would get the entire set of fakes?
Yes. And my concluding line to that was, I'm no Charlie Epps, but I'm going to say statistically not very likely.
No, it wouldn't be. Especially since they were just like switching them around, right? Like,
yes.
I guess if they had kept them both separate, then obviously, you'd get one set of real ones, one set of fake ones, but they weren't. They were swapping them around. So, yeah.
So, statistically, it's not very likely that that would happen.
No.
Steele, it makes a good punchline.
It does. Yeah, because he is crestfallen, saying the treacherous trio has the real ones, and Laura adds that some customs inspector has them now thanks to their tip. Mildred is impressed they put one over on Conant. She implies they might get a commendation for their work, and Steele mutters that that isn't the reward he had in mind.
No.
Laura sidles up to him and kisses him, saying, what's a six-figure reward compared to the knowledge that he's helped put four dangerous criminals behind bars? As he says this, her hand is sneaking into his inside his suit jacket. Steele dryly says, if you care so little for money, Miss Holt, then why are you filching my wallet?
Yes.
Here's my question.
Okay.
She sidles up to him and kisses him right in front of Mildred. this kind of physical closeness does not seem surprising to Mildred at all. So do you think they've said something to Mildred, or did she just clue in?
I would say they have never been particularly discreet.
Yeah, at least
in the second season and later, the latter part of the first season, certainly as well. So I'm going to say, it wouldn't have been hard to pick up on.
Fair. It just seems like Laura is perfectly comfortable doing so as well. So she's obviously, like, there's an awareness, I guess, between all of them that this is not unusual.
Mm-hmm. Mildred may have questions about their HR sexual harassment policy. But
right, because Mildred is not aware of even if she were aware of the dynamics the other way around, technically Laura is his employer.
There are so many possible legal questions involved in this that Mildred has to be asking herself, that it's like, well, when's my turn to be harassed?
Yeah, it was Well, he did kiss her on their honeymoon in Acapulco. So.
That's true. That's true.
And she did see him take off his pants. So I guess that's true.
Yeah.
Anyway, so that's the end of our episode. That was our tag scene. which, yeah. Again, I enjoy parts of this episode. It's not a bad episode.
But it's not memorable.
No, it really isn't particularly memorable. Like, I'll watch it and I'll be like, oh, yeah, this is the one with the Pipkins. But other than... Mm-hmm. than that, and the sort of secondhand embarrassment I get from Laura's little thieving bit, it's a fine way to spend 45 minutes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But nothing we would write home about.
Speaking of episodes we would write home about, the next episode, that's yours.
Yes. Love Among the Steel.
Yeah.
Yeah. So. That one will be.
on our website. www.steelwatching.com. We've got show notes, links to Amazon US, Amazon Canada, also things like if you want to help us out, make a donation, all that kind of stuff. There are also social media resources and links, such as
the official Steel Watching Facebook page, the official Twitter and Instagram pages, and then a link to the Steel Watchers fan group, which is not officially affiliated with the podcast,
but kind of
we love it. And they tolerate us.
Yeah, they let us do our thing.
Yes. So, yeah.
And then your episode, Love Among the Steel, which is an awesome episode. I'm looking forward to that one, like a lot.
Yeah. So,
yeah.
Pick up another car.
Yep, they do. And it's a great car. Like, it's not particularly
practical.
No, nor is it conspicuous, but
inconspicuous,
But
I mean, it's at the same level of conspicuous and inconspicuous that the limousine is, you know.
That's
so
true. That's true. Yeah,
they haven't exactly set a high standard for subtlety.
Mm-mm. No, they have not. And on that note, I guess we'll see everybody then, or not see every. See you then. Bye.
Bye-bye. Hey, everybody. Eric and Sarah here. Just a quick announcement to let you know that, yes, we do appreciate everyone who listens, participates, and supports the podcast in whatever way you do. But we wanted to give an extra thank you to those who are so graciously giving to be monthly financial supporters.
We are making live streams of our recording sessions available to anyone who is a monthly financial supporter. So not only can you watch us live as we record our podcast episodes, you will be getting access to the raw, behind-the-scenes, unedited version of episodes before they get officially released.
And Sarah, does that include our mistakes and screw-ups and our humiliating...
Oh, yeah. Yes, it does. Every single one of them.
Every single one of them, yes. So again, this is just an extra thank you to those who are going above and beyond. But whether you choose to become a monthly financial supporter or not, we still love you. We want to say we thank you for your support, your encouragement, and your feedback.
If you want to become a monthly financial supporter, please visit our website at www.steelwatching.com to sign up.